You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Archaeology Show, episode 256.
On today's show, we talk about the oldest stone tools in Europe, a CRM project in Mexico, and a stone circle in Peru.
Let's dig a little deeper.
Oh, I really have nothing.
Underneath the stones?
Welcome to the show, everybody. I know you're doing fine.
Go ahead. Ask me how it's going.
So we took a week off last week, but we were on a cruise down in the Southern Caribbean, which was pretty fun. We actually got some archaeology in there, too. I mean, this is a first for me, I think for you, too. We went to our first national park outside of the 50 United States.
Yeah, we did. We were in San Juan. That's where the cruise took off from. And I'm a little bit of a national park junkie. You are too, but I feel like I'm a little bit more intense about it than you are. Yeah. And I really like getting the stamps in my little national park passport book. So when we saw there was one in San Juan, we were like, well, we have time to kill before the cruise, so we have to make this happen.
That's San Juan, Puerto Rico.
Yes, San Juan, Puerto Rico.
Yeah.
And that's where the cruise was taking off from. So we spent a whole day wandering around, not a whole day, like a whole morning wandering around the forts that make up the San Juan National Historic Site or something like that.
I think it's Historic Park or whatever.
Historic Park, yeah.
Yeah, whatever it is.
And that was really cool. It was really fun and beautiful. Gosh, just like views for miles everywhere you walk. I mean, hot, but views for miles.
Yeah, I thought it was cool. On one of the forts, you can go into these tunnels. And they had these tunnels just for getting around and to different areas of the fort without being exposed. Because, you know, there was a lot of people trying to take this fort many, many times. And it proved to be untakeable most of the time just because the walls were so thick and it was pretty easily defended. So, yeah, it was a cool place.
Yeah, very cool.
But
we enjoyed that for sure. So that was fun.
Yeah. You know who didn't have a fort to protect them?
Go on.
These early Ukrainians.
Wow.
They're not really Ukrainians, though. They're early,
early
Homo erectus. Very early humans.
Right.
Yeah. So this first article is from Science Alert, and it's called Archaeologist Just Uncovered the Oldest Evidence of Humans in Europe. And we also have the Nature article linked in the show notes, so go check that out.
Yep.
All right. So, again, oldest evidence of humans in Europe. And I'm glad they kind of worded it that way because it doesn't mean it's the oldest humans in Europe, but this is the oldest evidence that we have.
That's a very important distinction because you only know what you have evidence for, right?
Yeah.
So they could have been older.
Yeah.
But, or there could have been older occupations. We just don't know about it yet because we don't have the evidence.
Yeah, for sure. And you have to assume that if you find evidence of humans, especially early humans in one spot. Now, if you find evidence of 20th century humans somewhere, they probably flew there or took a boat, right? So they could have just arrived. But if you find evidence of any humans 30,000 years ago or more, or even 5,000 years ago or more, you have to assume that they've been there for a long time.
And
you're not like finding evidence of the advance party.
The like chances of stumbling on the first time a group arrives someplace is very unlikely. So you kind of have to assume that you're coming in the middle of the occupation somewhere, probably.
Well, we'd never know it. We'd never know if it was the first one.
Yeah, that's impossible really to say unless you have like migration paths and you can kind of like see what direction people are going, kind of. But
well, even so, what counts as first? Because chances are there was some party of people or even a single person that went somewhere first and then died or didn't make it, or it was hundreds or thousands of years before somebody tried it again. And it's just, you know, when did it stick, basically? You know, when was that first camp or whatever that was successful and then people, you know, married and had kids and did whatever they did and
maybe not
whatever
married,
they, whatever they, well, whatever they called it. They had, everybody's
whatever,
had some form
whatever
of marriage.
They called it, I guess.
I guess I shouldn't say marriage. They partnered up. But anyway, point is, it's not the first.
Right.
But it's the oldest evidence that we have.
Right.
So this was found at Korolevo Quarry in Ukraine. And again, this article is from, you know, 10th of March, 2024. And I don't know if it says in the Nature article, because I don't remember reading that. I read this a couple of weeks ago. If like when this excavation was actually done, like, is it a part of Ukraine that's like okay to be in? I'm not really sure how they're putting new evidence out of Ukraine right now.
Yeah, they didn't even talk about like it being in danger from the war. So I guess it's probably either somewhere that's fine or it's just lab analysis at this point in a safe place. So,
yeah.
So this is a quarry. So as you can imagine, what they found here was stone tools, right?
Yeah, these stone tools were created and used by Homo erectus. At least that's what they think. Mm-hmm. And again, this is the earliest evidence of hominid habitation on the European continent. Andy Ferris is an archaeologist at La Trobe University in Australia. According to him, the researchers here used to think that our earliest ancestors couldn't survive in these colder northern climates without fire or complex stone tools. Every time we think people couldn't survive somewhere, turns out they could.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely. So, and as usual, this find seems to disprove that idea.
Yeah. And I was kind of wondering when I was reading this article that they didn't find any evidence of fire in this particular area or this excavation or whatever. But that doesn't mean one of two things. Either A, that doesn't mean that there was no fire use in the area. Maybe they just didn't find it.
Right.
Or B, that it's so old that the fire, the evidence of fire has just dissipated into the ground. It's just gone. There's no charcoal left. There's no,
and it could, it could just be the preservation of the area too. Like charcoal doesn't stick around really well in all areas. Some places it does, some places it doesn't. So it could just be that the evidence is gone. It's totally a possibility.
Yeah. Now, when we start talking about the exodus out of Africa is what people really kind of refer to this as, you know, because Africa is where the real cradle of humanity is. Well, the early seeds of humanity, I guess. Mm-hmm. But people are always debating, you know, did humans and spring out of Homo erectus and Homo erectus spread all over the place? Because we found Homo erectus in China, in Northern Europe, and in, you know, France, Spain, stuff like that. We found Homo erectus all over the place. But did Homo erectus lead into the other hominid versions and then humans eventually all over the place? Or did humans spring up somewhere and then spread out across from wherever they sprang up?
Right.
But some still think that humanity evolved out of a single cradle, they call it, in, in one part of the world. This find, and to be quite honest, many others, provide evidence that Homo sapiens may have been moving across Europe much earlier than thought. Now, we're talking about Homo erectus here.
Right.
But Homo erectus is an ancestor of Homo sapiens. Right. So,
Yeah.
And I was just wondering, you know, are we really shocked at all that human migration is way more complicated than we previously thought?
I know, like, we're dealing with sites that are so old and there's so few of them, and you're filling in gaps as you find things, of course. But like, there is just so much unknown about what happened in this really long stretch of time, a very long time ago. So, of course, it's more complicated than we thought. And of course, it's more interesting even than we thought, too. You know, it's great. Most of what we find that is that old are stone tools, obviously, because you might have some bones. They'll be fossilized if you do find them. There are other artifacts maybe that might, if the preservation conditions are favorable, they might be preserved. But mostly what you find are stone tools. And that is kind of a problem for dating, though, because you can't really date stone tools. So you have to rely on relative dating, which is the stuff around the stone tools, probably with stuff this old. You're talking about like geological layers and stuff like that is what you're using to pinpoint where this stuff, you know, dates to.
At least you couldn't date stone tools.
At least you couldn't. Yeah. I know this article is really, this article is really cool. It almost belongs on Archaeotech. Like, I feel like you and Paul need to talk about this because this technique is crazy. I've never heard of it before, but it's really cool.
We'll get to that in a minute.
Yeah.
The site in Ukraine is 14 meters deep and contains thousands of artifacts dating back many millennia. Mm-hmm. There's at least seven separate periods of hominid occupation across at least nine Paleolithic cultures. Mm-hmm. And this goes back about 30,000 years on this one site. So long time. Mm-hmm. There are no biological remains, which they've found.
Okay.
So that rules out radiocarbon dating.
Typical in such an old site. So not surprising.
Right. And over the years of excavation, researchers have relied on the positions of the artifacts to say that, you know, these ones are deeper and older. Mm-hmm. Therefore, they're, you know, they're deeper because they're older, or they're older because they're deeper.
Right.
Yeah. It's actually, you know, long accepted law in geology, which is the law of superposition, which means generally if something's lower, it must be older. Mm-hmm. Now, they thought that a long time ago, but then when they started realizing that, hey, entire plates could like flip themselves over.
Yeah.
You got to be careful with that.
Yeah, you do have to follow that, the threads of the geology to make sure that everything is in place the way it was 30,000 years ago.
But, yeah. But luckily for us, that takes millions of years, not 30,000 years to do.
Right.
So we know that deeper stuff is generally older. Now, there are things from an archaeological standpoint that could move stuff older and out of context.
Yes.
And that's animals.
Yep.
It's tree roots. Mm-hmm. It's water action.
Yep.
It's all kinds of stuff that could transport artifacts
Yeah.
From where they were initially deposited.
Yeah, you kind of have to like look at it as a whole. And if you have one artifact that's way deeper than everything else, then you need to really examine how that could have gotten there. And if it looks like it's at the bottom of like a rodent burrow or something, then, you know, maybe it just got dragged there by accident by animal activity. So there's a lot of like interpreting the context, I think, that goes along with this as well.
All right. So what they use to date this is, like we said, a brand new dating technique that we'd never heard of.
It's been around
for a while in other areas, but it doesn't seem like it's been applied to archaeology very often.
Yeah.
A team led by the archaeologist Roman Garba of the Czech Academy of Sciences used a new precision dating technique called cosmogenic nuclide burial dating.
Another unmemorable and hard to pronounce dating technique.
Right.
I find that they all just like jumble around in my brain. Yeah. So yay, one more to roll around in there.
I know. This dating technique relies on the fact that when a rock is on the surface, it is bombarded with cosmic rays.
Okay.
This is just literally cosmic rays from the universe, right? Just hitting it.
Yeah. Not visible, just like...
Well, you're being hit by cosmic rays right
Exactly. Now. Just like existing on the surface. This is what happens to everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They use this to look at the decay rates of specific atomic nuclei and then measure the amount of time that's passed since burial. Now, this is the same as radiocarbon dating.
Mm-hmm.
It's the transformation of carbon 12 into carbon 14.
Mm-hmm.
And there's other types of dating techniques like uranium thorium dating and potassium argon dating.
Right. You know,
that potassium argon is used in like Africa anytime you've got like a basalt layer.
Oh yeah.
It's the decay rate. And that relies on what's called the half-life, if you've never heard of that. And all of these like radiometric particles that emit radiation, they have a half-life, which means that over a given unit of time, half of it will be left.
Right.
And if you know what the half-life is of the chemical, then that's the further back you can go. And this is why you can't use radiocarbon dating back more than, it's about 50 to 60,000 years, because the half-life is only something like 5,600 years or something like that. And so in 5,600 years, half of what you had is gone.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time you hit about 50,000 years, there's not enough of it left to really do anything with.
Yeah.
So, but the half-life of some of these other things is extremely long, sometimes in the millions of years.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a lot easier to say that there's
to
stuff that's left and to measure it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Now you have to kind of know how much was left.
Mm-hmm.
And you measure these ratios. But at this one, they measured the concentrations of the cosmogenic nuclides of beryllium-10 and aluminum-26. And these, of course, have different half-lives.
Mm-hmm.
The nuclides accumulate in quartz grains and begin to decay as soon as they are buried. So as soon as they're no longer
exposed to the atmosphere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then they start decaying. The ratio of these two gives the researchers the length of time that the rock was buried.
Oh, so they need two different ones and then they're looking at the ratio, basically.
Yeah, that's how all these half-lives work.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, because one's decaying into the other, basically.
Yeah, okay.
So, well, actually, in this case, they're not decaying into the other. They're each decaying separately, but they know the half-lives of these things. And so.
I guess if you have two, it just makes your dating more precise because you're looking at two different things. So,
they used a mathematics-based model to determine the age of the sediment layers. And apparently this is the first time this technique was used for archaeological dating. Not like a mathematics-based model.
Mm-hmm.
We do kind of stuff like that all the time. But this particular cosmogenic dating technique.
Mm-hmm.
So the earliest age they observed with this method was actually 1.42 million years.
Wow.
This is the date of the oldest tools in the assemblage.
Wow.
This is what they said.
Wow.
So that's actually quite old.
Yeah. Super old.
So it looks like Homo erectus was in Europe by 1.4 million years ago and then got there by migrating through Asia about 1.8 million years ago.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So when we mentioned all the thousands of artifacts earlier, that was obviously the more recent artifacts.
Yeah. Because we talked about it going back 30,000 years, but this is the whole assemblage for this area.
Yeah. I'm guessing. Paleolithic cultures.
Yeah.
You know, that we are aware of. And then, you know, the oldest stone tools we're talking about.
Okay. Yeah.
So anyway, these are the oldest ever Homo erectus fossils, date to around 2 million years ago. And these were found in a cave in South Africa, where all the good stuff is found.
Mm-hmm.
So it's clear that more needs to be done and more Homo erectus needs to be found in Europe and more sites like this. But it's also pretty clear that Homo erectus was a pretty significant player on the European landscape.
Yeah.
So I think we've already known that, but we just keep solidifying that thought.
Well, like we said earlier, it's really hard to date stone artifacts. Obviously, you have relative dating, but that's not always real great depending on the context you find it in. So being able to use this kind of dating. Now, I imagine if this is only going to work if you. So you're measuring the cosmic rays, basically.
Well,
right?
The amounts of two different nucleides.
Yeah. So when you're collecting these artifacts for dating, they can't be exposed to the atmosphere again because that would skew the dating, right?
Good point. Yeah.
So are they like collecting like a like a chunk of dirt and just keeping it enclosed in the dirt and taking it somewhere where it can be protected from exposure?
Well, and I'm not sure how much of a penetrating factor these cosmic rays actually have. We're talking 14 meters deep here at the lowest levels.
Yeah.
So chances are there wasn't a lot of daylight down there to begin with, depending on how big the excavation was. And if they covered over the top, is that enough to prevent the cosmic rays?
Right.
Like I'm inside an aluminum RV right now. Are cosmic rays hitting me? Or are they blocked by that?
Yeah.
Right? Like it depends.
Yeah, I guess so. But it does make you think that if you're going to plan to use this kind of dating, which it seems like anybody who's trying to look at early human anything anywhere would want to use this because it's great for stone artifacts, right?
Mm-hmm.
That they're going to have to plan for how to protect the artifacts from contamination before they can get to the testing. So yeah, really interesting. And I also imagine you won't be able to go back and do this kind of testing to artifacts that have been found already because they've been sitting out exposed wherever. So this is like a moving forward new excavation kind of technique that you would have to use.
Yeah, this just goes to show that you never know what kind of future techniques are going to be developed. Yeah. So it's always handy to, I would say probably if you can, almost just preserve in as much a way as you possibly can some sort of block of soil or even some artifacts untouched until possibly something you don't even know is invented or has been invented but not applied to archaeology comes around, and then somebody could test this later on, because there's so many things that you just can't.
You just don't know.
You can't contaminate.
You could even like leave a portion of the site unexcavated just for future for future excavation with different technology. You wouldn't want to excavate it with the same technology 10 years from now, but maybe 20, 30 years, things have really like moved forward. Yeah. It might be a good time to revisit a site and do new different processes. So,
of course, the risk you run into there is if you leave it unexcavated, you don't know what's there.
You don't know.
You could be leaving nothing.
True. Yeah, that's true. You got to have a good bet that there's something there that you're not excavating, right?
Which is why I personally think that you should just, you know, take a block or a portion of the excavation and just record it in or excavate it in such a way that you're minimizing exposure. You're dressed up in suits, you're in gloves and all kinds of stuff, because you literally have no idea what kind of technique could be used later on.
Yeah, you can do the best you can. It's just, you never know what's going to come in the future. How could anybody have guessed that they'd be measuring these particles and like how they need to be dealt with and handled in a way to keep contamination from happening, you know?
Right.
So yeah, crazy.
Well, just like you never know when you're digging a sewer project, whether or not you're going to find a pile of skulls like the Mexicans did. Let's talk about that on the other side of the break. Welcome back to episode 256 of the Archaeology Show. And again, this time we're talking about a CRM project. And it was a construction project in the small town of Pozo de Ibarra in the Mexican state of Jalisco. Hmm. Archaeologists from the National Institute of Anthropology and History were monitoring the construction of a sanitary sewage network. I would hate to see an unsanitary sewage network. Monitoring is often used in archaeology. We've both done it.
Yes.
To observe construction and protect any cultural artifacts that might be found. Because sometimes you might be working in an area that doesn't necessarily warrant excavation because things weren't found there, but maybe a lot of stuff has been found in the area, or you know, it's a, you know, like in England, I'm pretty sure they monitor everything because you can't drop a spoon in the ground without finding a Roman artifact or something like that, right?
So, well, and with construction work, like you might not be able to do like a typical archaeological survey because it's all paved or the whole area has been disturbed.
Yeah.
So all you can really do is let the construction equipment get in there and start doing what they're doing, and you watch as they do it and stop them if they if it looks like they're disturbing a site or something important is you know, needs to be protected, basically.
Yeah. Well, in this case, they really kind of hit the mother load here.
Yeah.
What they found was, they're calling a funerary system, where a series of bones were arranged. There were long bones like tibias and femurs placed in one part of the system. And they're all actually kind of
so
close
crazy
to each other when we say system, but they're just calling it that. And then there was a whole bunch of skulls just like stacked on top of each other in another part of the system. And I guess not a whole bunch. There was about 7 complete skulls.
Yeah.
Each belonging to males.
Yes.
So they said.
Yeah, it's really cool. They are of different ages and some show signs of cranial modification. And this would be a practice where the shape of the skull was modified for aesthetic purposes. I'm thinking like where you do like a flattened back of the skull. Potentially you can do it like when the person is a baby, you know, you can put a board against their head and flatten the skull that way and things like that. So I guess I imagine it's something like that, but they didn't really describe what they meant by the modifications exactly. So
yeah, and it looks like the bones were placed in this funerary system after the flesh and other soft material was gone. So they didn't bury a bunch of heads and legs.
No.
Yeah.
They did not dismember them. There would have been cut marks if they were dismembered and put this way. So for some reason, they let all the flesh, you know, decompose away, and they were left with just a pile of bones, and then they organized the bones like this. It's so strange, right? Like, why do that?
I guess that's what makes this a complex funerary system in their terms.
Yeah. Well, they definitely did something with intention here. So. Yeah.
It also appears that all the bones were buried at the same time. They can probably tell that because they do look like they're literally buried on top of each other, like in a pile.
Yeah, the picture's neat. Yeah, definitely check out the article so you can see the picture.
Yeah, if these were buried at different times, there would be layers of dirt and things like that. So it looks like a hole was dug and these were tossed in there. But not tossed in. They were definitely placed in a way that was thoughtful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. The INAH has no idea why the bones were buried this way, and there's no precedent for it that they've read about or seen in the area. So, which kind of strikes me as odd. There's been a lot of funerary complex type things found in Mexico and Central America, and I'm just surprised they never found anything like this.
Yeah, this feels more like the European crypt situation, you know, where you have like skulls displayed in an underground tomb situation, you know, but that was a more specific burial practice where like that was your final resting place like that. So this is different because it's buried, it's underground, like the different bones are separated. I can almost like see like that sort of logical human thing though. Like maybe they had the remains of these individuals that they had to bury. They had to move them for some reason, whatever that reason might've been. And when you're doing that, you know, it's just easier to grab up a bunch of long bones, like sticks in your arms almost, you know, like maybe it was just as simple as that. You know, do we have to assign a ritual or a meaning or a ceremony to it? And people are still people, you know,
it's true.
I think researchers like to forget that sometimes.
Well, that being said, what they think might be happening, because there is, I guess they said there was no precedence for this, but then they go on to say, yeah, but we've kind of seen this before, sort of, but maybe just not buried this way. But I guess what they're suggesting is that the seven men might be from one family and that they were buried there as part of a rite to found a settlement. And that practice may date back to the Amapa cultural era, which was from about 500 CE to 800 or 850 CE. So apparently they have seen that kind of a thing before where it's like
your ancestors are buried.
Yeah. Somewhere. You're just like putting a hold on this place for your, you know, for you and say, hey, but I'm like, did they have to sacrifice seven people for that? Or were they already,
were they already dead
and they reburied them over there?
Yeah. And they just moved the bones.
Cause if they had dug up, graves, like, cause maybe they were moving from one place to the next. I'm just guessing here, but if they moved from one place to the next, they could have dug it up. Then they would have had all the bones and they would have just organized them and said, okay, we'll put all these here since we don't know who they belong to.
Yeah.
And then we'll just put all the heads here. You know, I don't know.
Yeah. That is interesting. I mean, I guess I could see that. I still think that my previous statement holds though. Like, we need a lot more evidence to know why they put all the long bones together, why they put all the heads together. And I think it could just be as simple as like, hold your arms out.
Right.
Let me pile all these here. Yeah. And like the long bones just naturally like go into your arms like firewood. They just do, you know, and or sticks or something. And then you can just put them all together and the heads are easy to carry, like one, two or three together. I don't know. Like I could see it just being like natural human behavior to just pick them up and carry them like that. Now, as to why they did it, though, that is really interesting to think that they might have been marking their territory somehow from a physical standpoint, like this is my land and I now own it, or like from a spiritual standpoint, like
this is anchoring them spiritually to the area.
It could probably be either
that sounds
or
like
both
more what they're thinking.
They
sounds like this was a relatively recent discovery, and there was a news release that was about this, not a paper, so they're still working on it, because they did find ceramic vessels and figurines, and may help them actually date this complex a little bit later on. I would assume those would be burial goods.
Yeah.
Because this was all kind of one shot.
Right.
It doesn't seem like it was buried in context with something else. So.
Totally. I wonder if they can do DNA analysis on the bones themselves, too, to find out if they are actually related as they are indicating they might be in their sort of hypothesis, right?
They don't say they're fossilized, and something can fossilize in that short a period of time if the conditions are right, but it's unlikely.
Yeah.
So they probably aren't fossilized. So yeah, they might be able to.
Yeah, because I mean, they might not be able to date necessarily the bones that way, but they could do DNA analysis to find relationship potentially.
Well, and I believe it's strontium isotope analysis they can do on the teeth. I can actually see teeth in some of these skulls here.
Yeah.
They can do that to kind of find out what the diet of the person would have been and then to find out whether they're actually from that area or from some other area. So maybe if they're all from some other area, maybe it does, it would indicate that a group came from somewhere, came to somewhere else and they needed this tie to the land. So they buried their ancestors there.
Yeah, you know, totally.
Or
buried,
or sacrificed seven people. Who knows?
maybe this is the family that used to live on this land, and they're like, "Bye, guys. Yeah, it's ours now."
Thanks for the house.
Oh man, who knows? It's hard to know the intention of people in the past, right? So we just have to like guess.
And not
the one thing I hate that researchers do. And we've talked about this before. Is to give a reason or a possibility and say, this is what they did. Exactly. You know, you just don't know.
But they're not saying that.
You have to crack the door a little bit more. You know? They're not. They're suggesting.
Yeah, they're saying it might be this.
Yeah.
Yeah, they don't know what it is.
And they clearly have said that they need to do more research. So yeah, for sure. But definitely leave that door cracked because we don't know at all.
All right. Well, some other archaeologists that are guessing are down in Peru because they've got a mysterious stone circle that they're trying to figure out what it was for. We'll talk about that on the other side. Welcome back to the Archaeology Show, episode 256. And this article was actually reported in Newsweek. Mm-hmm. And it's Archaeologists Discover Mysterious Stone Circle Built Before the Great Pyramids. I feel like everything is either in context of the pyramids or Stonehenge. It's like how we measure everything in football fields.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I guess it gives context to people who may not necessarily know when things happen, but everybody knows Stonehenge and the pyramids are old. So I guess related to that. Sure.
So this is a circular stone plaza that is 2/3 of a football field wide. And
is that even right?
And 1,000 football fields above sea level.
Ridiculous.
Right. Actually, it's 100 football fields above sea level.
Anyway,
so it's a circular stone plaza measured about 18 meters or 60 feet in diameter, which is about 2/3 of a football field. And it's been discovered in the Andes Mountains of Peru.
I legit have no idea how big a football field is. So you're right.
It's 100 yards. Oh, I'm completely wrong. 60 feet is not even close.
Yeah, a yard is 3 feet. So
yeah, so 60 feet would be like 20 yards. So it's like it's a fifth of a football field.
Okay, there you go. I'm really glad that we went through that math.
Now that we've nailed that down,
established the football field size. Great. Right. Okay, so
the structure consists of two concentric walls made from unshaped stones, which just means they weren't modified, set vertically into the ground. And you can see this on a nice aerial view picture in the article. So really take a look at it. It seems pretty obvious. You could probably see it from a satellite image if you knew exactly where it was.
Yeah, you probably could. I can't believe you haven't been like scrolling around on the map to find it.
I just thought about that.
So the site is in northern Peru's Cajamarca Valley at the Calakpuma archaeological site. And the site is at about 10,000 feet above sea level and it's near the summit of a peak in the Andes.
Yeah.
And I was super excited about this article because I've actually been to Cajamarca.
Oh, yeah.
It's a really cool town in northern Peru, like they said, and it's got just like a great, I don't know, like Andean vibe to it, you know? It's all hills everywhere you walk in that city. Now, this is outside of the city. You can kind of see the city in the background. I think probably that's Cajamarca. And it's just like all mountains, high elevation. Every step is like a little bit painful because you're at such a high elevation.
Yeah.
But it's beautiful and the culture is vibrant and amazing and they have wonderful hot springs there. So it's a really cool place.
I have no idea what an Andean vibe is.
Well, you've got like all these little old ladies that are dressed in like the vibrant clothing of the Andes, the big tall hats, you know, that you see like the Indian women wearing and the men too. I think they wear those like crazy tall hat things. And yeah, there's a market around every corner and the food is fresh. And I don't know, it's just got this cool like vibe to it. I loved going there. It was, so I did field school in Peru 3 times and the like final little like, yay, you did it trip was always to Cajamarca and we'd spend the last like day or two there and go to the hot springs and experience the city. It's a cool place.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, they did find some charcoal near the bases of some of these stones. Mm-hmm. So, of course, what does that mean? Radiocarbon dating.
Radiocarbon dating. Yep. Yep.
So they analyzed the radiocarbon there and found out, well, this is another thing. I don't know if Newsweek is reporting this way or if they really said this, because I can't imagine they did. Mm-hmm. But they're saying that means the construction took place around 4,750 years ago. And I'm like, somebody 4,750 years ago could have just gone up there and burned a fire next to the structure and had some other reason for being there.
Well, that's why I would want more information about the context that this carbon was found in. Is it like slightly underneath the stone, as in it was there before the stone was put into place? I feel like that would be different, right?
I feel like they'd have to pull the stone off completely to see that, because even if it was just on the edges, it could have washed in.
It could have fallen in.
It could have, you know, there's a lot of ways it could have gotten in there.
Yeah. But yeah, it would be hard to say that this is exactly when the construction took place.
Now, one thing that might help make their point, though, is that if there was like a lot of charcoal samples and they did it on all of them and they all came out with around the same date, that was like the only time somebody was there, then maybe. But it's also like, well, did they have to burn fires to make this thing, you know, or was it used in some sort of ritual capacity? We'll talk about this later, which might include fires and things like that. It's hard to say if it had anything to do with the construction or just the use.
Yeah, or natural, right? Like fires happen too. I mean, you can't count out. You can't assume that carbon you find is based on something done by people. It could just be from a natural fire.
That's true. But if it's from a natural fire, I think you're going to find it all over the place.
True. Yeah. Very true. There'd be like a whole layer. And like looking at this image, it's a pretty barren landscape. So like a natural fire would be difficult for a natural fire to start up there probably.
But. And here we go. We've got both the cultural markers in one statement here. According to researchers, it was built about 100 years before the Great Pyramids, which is oddly specific.
It is.
And of Egypt, and about the same time as Stonehenge. And also 100 years before the pyramids, that is, I don't even think within the error bars of radiocarbon dating. Like it could have been built at the same time or 100 years later, you know, maybe, or unless their error bars have it solidly within 100 years before.
Yeah.
But I don't know. It depends on
if they have a lot of overlapping samples. Maybe they're able to narrow down the date range.
Who knows?
Better. Yeah. Maybe.
It seems like it was made just so they could make the statement that it was built before the pyramids.
Well, they do love to compare.
Structures like this, prehistoric structures like this, using large stones, are known around the world as monumental megalithic architecture. And I feel like monumental megalithic needs to be the name of like a heavy metal band. Yeah.
That's a good string of words there. I know, right?
This is one of the earliest examples of such a structure in the Americas, though. So that's kind of cool. Mm-hmm. There are some few slightly earlier examples in the Andes themselves and lots more recent ones. Mm-hmm. But this is the earliest in the Cajamarca region of northern Peru.
Mm-hmm. This one is distinct, however, because the construction method using large, freestanding, and vertically placed stones is distinct from other monumental plazas in the Andes.
I'm guessing they used it for time travel.
Time travel.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sure. Whatever you say, ancient aliens.
I was going for an Outlander vibe there.
Oh, you were? Oh, okay. Gotcha. Yeah, definitely. Pass through the stones right there.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
So the people in this area at this time lived in relatively small groups and were mostly still mobile. They were likely to still be hunting and gathering most of the time. So kind of moving around the landscape and going where they needed to go to get the resources that they needed.
Mm-hmm.
They did begin experimenting with agriculture and food production at this time. So maybe a little bit of a hybrid model going on, you know, settling down to grow some food here, but moving to follow game, you know, kind of that sort of situation maybe. Maybe some animal domestication.
Yeah.
Yeah. So a little bit of settling. So kind of sounds like a hybrid situation.
Yeah. At this particular site, they didn't find any domestic artifacts.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that and the fact they didn't really find anything else except for these charcoal samples means they don't really know what the function of this plaza would have been.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like apparently there's no more recent examples with ethnographic evidence either. So ethnographic is just somebody physically talked to or wrote down an account of somebody, you know, back in the 1600s or something.
Yeah.
You know, that's one way we can learn stuff, but apparently there's none of that.
Well, I mean, this is 4,000 years ago, right? So like,
well, I'm just saying if this kind of practice persisted through time,
we might have an idea
of at least how they were being used a few hundred years ago.
Right.
You know, but obviously nobody was.
Yeah.
So. An archaeologist associated with the project thinks it served as a gathering place and ceremonial location. Take a drink.
Yeah.
For some of the earliest people living in the part of the Cajamarca Valley. Now, that does actually kind of probably make a little sense
it
because
does.
This is really high elevation. probably relatively difficult to get to. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I don't care when it was and what kind of people you were, you would still have to get used to staying at that elevation. Mm-hmm. So it was probably a little bit of a challenge. Yeah, I don't know why you would have just stayed up there for long periods of time. I mean, that being said, too, we have examples in Nevada's White Mountains of people, like villages at 10,000 feet, mm-hmm. you know, and above. Mm-hmm. So people did it.
You just adapt to that that elevation, and it's not really a problem anymore, I don't think. I mean, it seems like plenty of people around the world did it, because there's plenty of high elevation cultures in the past and today, too, that live at those kind of elevations. So, yeah.
Yeah. I also had a problem with them calling the earliest people living in the Cuyahoga Valley, only just because the article didn't really get into what the, I guess, ethnographic evidence around there is about 5,000 years really as old as people were down there. You know, is that the oldest evidence of people in that valley that we have? I don't really know.
Yeah, I guess I don't really know either, but
yeah,
I mean, it is pretty old, right? So right. I could see that being some of the oldest people in the valley for sure. Yeah.
I wrote down a quote from one of the researchers directly from the article. I'm just going to read it right now. Mm-hmm. I suspect, and I am not the first archaeologist to propose this kind of idea, that people came from one group or members of several nearby groups, either came together under the leadership of some aspiring person or, and just as likely, that they came together more collectively in order to build this monument. We may never know exactly what happened and why the monument was built, but at a time when people were just beginning to settle down, there might have been some desire to make a physical, material claim to local resources and lands. This seems like a pretty high altitude area to claim anything down in the valley, first off. But
true, but if he's talking about a bunch of groups coming together,
yeah, they would need some sort of neutral place to maybe do that.
Yeah, and like you're not going to be using that high elevation spot for anything other than maybe grazing animals or something, right? So not living for sure. So it could be, a place for you to come together, but not impact where you're trying to actually settle down and build your communities. I guess I could see that. And also it's high up on like a ridge. So if you're talking about a place with ceremonial or spiritual significance, then those higher places are, you know, the kind of places that you've seen in other cultures. So I guess, I can see that. It's reaching, but it's reaching in a direction that makes sense based on what they found or didn't find.
And,
you know?
And one of the reasons why they're going towards the multiple groups coming together thing is because monumental architecture of this size is often associated with relative social complexity just because of the organization and planning you would need for construction, the sheer number of people, the vision. Somebody has to have the vision and direct people and guide where it's going to go. And, you know, that's tough to do unless you've got some sort of organization going on.
Yeah. And like the idea that it's under the leadership of a person makes sense, too, because like how in the world could you get enough people to come together to move these ridiculously heavy stones into place in a large monumental architecture thing like this, unless it is a really inspiring person who has a really good reason for you to do it. Coming together under the leadership of one person does kind of make sense to me. You see it with the pyramids in Egypt is a really great example of that. On a massive scale. Yeah. So like, sure. Under the leadership of a really strong person, that does make sense to me too.
Yeah. Their next steps are to use non-invasive remote sensing techniques, probably something like ground penetrating radar or depending on the surface, you know, resistivity and some other stuff that they could use depending on the soil, I guess. And they're going to try to find like buried walls or other features that may be associated. So that's what they're going to do next.
Yeah. Because if they can find some places where people were living, then that might change this completely. Right.
Yeah.
Or help narrow in on what the function of the circle was. So.
Yeah. And the other thing is this wasn't, like we said, easy to get to. So they suspect when people came to this site, possibly periodically, that they did live nearby and they'll be trying to find evidence of that as well.
Yeah. Like a temporary living situation as opposed to a permanent one, maybe.
But this wasn't a day trip. It was 10,000 feet in elevation.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was hard to climb.
Yeah. You had to get there and like chill for a minute before you could even function probably.
Well, and it might have taken it could have taken somebody in really good shape a day to get there, but the whole family, a whole bunch of people lugging up all their stuff. I don't know. Maybe, maybe not. But they could have taken their time to get there, depending on where they were coming from. And then when they did get there, it could have been, you know, a longer period of time that they were staying there. So
for sure.
All right. Any final thoughts on this?
No. I mean, it's a really cool part of the world. So it's neat to see this kind of monumental architecture in a different way than we hear about it usually coming from Peru. You know, you hear so much about Machu Picchu and the stuff that was built by the Incans, you know. But this is much older and just probably for a totally different purpose. So really, really cool.
All right. We'll see you next week.
Okay. Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.arcpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at ArcPodNet. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Rachel Roden.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.